So I'm Mark A. Bell, family physician and professor at the University of Georgia and editor-in-chief of Essential Evidence Plus.
I'm John Hickner, also a family physician and editor-in-chief of the Journal of Family Practice.
Hi, I'm Henry Mary. Guess what? I'm a family physician. I'm also one of the co-founders of InfoPalms.
Yes, that's right. We're all family physicians. Welcome to a special edition of Primary Care Update, where we're going to focus exclusively on research into the new COVID-19 disease. We plan to do more frequent interim podcasts in addition to our usual podcasts until either the pandemic wanes or you tell us to stop. These are based on research briefs that we're preparing daily for American Family Physician on their homepage. A colleague and mentor of ours, Jim Pochin, said that one gift you can share and still keep is knowledge. In that spirit, these are copyright free. You can share them freely without permission requests and you know, let your friends know about these Primary Care Update podcasts. Like I said, we're going to be every other week at least, and probably also as part of our regular podcast, bringing you some of the latest research on COVID-19. So the first report we want to cover, it's not actually a published study yet, but it is a report that the FDA has approved the first antibody test for IgG and IgM from Cellus. They report that it is 94% sensitive and 96% specific compared with PCR. Now, while that sounds super, super accurate, we have to be very careful before using it to tell folks that they are immune and safe. So first, we don't even know the extent to which previous infection confers immunity, although I suspect it probably does, at least for a while. Also, if the prevalence of previous COVID-19 infection is only 10%, so you have a population maybe in the general public where they don't have any specific recall of an infection, the 96% specificity means you have about a 70% positive predictive value. So for every 10 people you tell, congrats, you're immune, 3 actually won't be. So we really need these tests to be as close to 100% specific as possible. There are some in Europe, the Johns Hopkins Biohealth Defense page, or I think it's Bioterrorism Defense page, has a list of these. And they are, we link to that in Essential Evidence Plus as well. But we'd like to see those tests be very specific. So bottom line, on the front end, when you're diagnosing new cases, sensitivity is really important because you don't want to miss anyone and tell them you don't have the infection, go home and, you know, infect everyone that you know. On the back end, when you're trying to assess immunity and get people back into society, specificity is what really matters. Any comments, Henry, John?
Yeah. So in addition to the point about informing our patients if they are immune or not, this is so critical to better understanding where we are with regards to the pandemic. We're not doing universal testing of people who are symptomatic. We are highly selective in those who are at the highest risk for complications, people with other kinds of risk factors, people with mild symptoms we're telling to stay home. So we really will have no way of knowing the full extent of the disease until we actually start doing antibody testing.
John, any thoughts?
Yes, one other comment for those of you who thought that Mark was presenting some kind of hocus pocus. It's probably time for you to go back and review the concepts of positive and negative predictive value. They really are more important for us as clinicians than the concepts of sensitivity and specificity.
Good point. And the predictive values, the positive and negative predictive value, they answer the clinically important question of, given a positive test, what's the likelihood of disease, or given a negative test, what's the likelihood of no disease? But they depend on that underlying prevalence. When a test is, or when a disease is quite common, positive and negative predictive value can be quite different from when it's rare. So yeah, good time to refresh on that. The next study, this is actually from what we call a preprint server, MedRxiv, and what they do, and this is an increasingly popular thing to do even before COVID-19, but especially now, is a research group will do a study. They will publish it on the server while they're waiting to get it peer-reviewed and published. So these are non-peer-reviewed trials, so you have to take it with, you know, that caveat in mind. But this one came from Zhang et al., and it's called Efficacy of Hydroxychloroquine in Patients with COVID-19, Results of a Randomized Clinical Trial. Certainly, this is a drug in the news. It's been touted by our president based on a couple of old in vitro studies. So we really need randomized trials looking at clinical endpoints in human beings. There are a bunch of these trials underway, and they're now starting to come out of China. So this study randomized 62 patients who had mild COVID-19 infection to hydroxychloroquine 200 milligrams twice daily for 5 days or usual care. So the authors describe the study as double-blinded, but they don't mention anything about the control group getting a placebo or masking actually occurring. So we kind of not sure about that. All the patients had an oxygen saturation greater than 93%. Patients in the hydroxychloroquine group experienced relief from fever a bit earlier, 1 day earlier, and cough 1 day earlier than controls. Of 31 patients in the control group, 9 worsened, 5 were unchanged, and 17 improved. This compares with 2 worsened, 4 unchanged, and 25 improved in the hydroxychloroquine group. So more patients improved, fewer patients worsened in the hydroxychloroquine group. But the concerns about the study design, the fact that it's awaiting peer review, means we really need to be very cautious about this. There have been other similar small studies that have found less optimistic results, shall we say.
And this seems like a very select group of patients, because I'm not hearing about many patients that only have fever for an additional 2 or 3 days or cough for an additional 2 or 3 days after they're diagnosed. So it just doesn't all add up to me.
Yeah. And you know, this is, you know, we really need good evidence and all the evidence, not just sort of cherry picked studies. When you have a bunch of these small studies that are starting to come out, some of them just by chance could show a benefit. We really don't have enough information from this study yet to make us confident in the results. Henry?
Yeah, your point is right on that we've had a couple of inconsistent outcomes on small trials. And so we really do need to make sure that we're looking at all of the data and all of the various relevant subgroups. And in the past, I've shared ideas as to why there may be conflicting guidelines. And I think this is a time where, you know, when we're looking at recommendations from people who have historically shunned science, why are they making recommendations? Well, part of it may be extrapolations beyond the in vitro types of studies. Some of it may be that, oh my gosh, we're desperate for anything and we're willing to put up with any potential harms. Or as Deep Throat told Woodward and Bernstein, follow the money. remember, there are harms with hydroxychloroquine, and not just the prolonged QT interval, but we're also reducing the supply for people who truly benefit, those patients with the inflammatory arthritides.
Yeah, I guess I'm less concerned about a financial conflict of interest given the relatively low cost of this the medication, but at least I think it's still cheap. I hope it's still cheap. But I think there's an optimistic bias, and I think people want to have good news very desperately, and they want to deliver good news. And I think that's also where some of this is coming from. John, anything to add? Nothing else. Okay. So no quizzes episode. We're going to reserve those for our usual episodes next week's next one. And this is the next is an update from Henry.
Yeah, so this is a summary from a paper published in JAMA on March 26th, just a week ago. And it compares the case fatality rates between Italy and China. And on the surface, the case fatality rate in Italy is over 7%, and it was just over 2% in China. Oh, by the way, as of last night's CDC data, the rate for the U.S. was about 2.5 to 3%. So the point that this paper makes, though, is that once you stratify based on age, up until the age of 70, it looks like it's pretty even. And then in Italy, where there's a much older population, the case fatality rate was a little bit higher for those individuals over 70. So there's some recurring lessons. In 2003, the World Health Organization released a report summarizing the SARS epidemic, and they cautioned against really looking at case fatality rates when you're in the middle or at the beginning part of an epidemic or a pandemic. You've also heard about the Imperial College model that's been on the news, and that actually reports infection fatality rates, which are different than case fatality rates. It's a subtlety where the infection fatality rate includes everybody who is infected, including those who are asymptomatic. That gets back to that point that we made earlier about the antibody testing. And so we may not know the infection fatality rate until the pandemic is actually broken. And then the last point that I wanted to make is that because we have different aging populations, different socioeconomic circumstances, different healthcare systems, we really are on a lot of thin ice when we try to compare fatality rates from one country to another. Mark, John, well, comments?
Yeah, sure. We'll comment. I'll always comment. Yeah, I think it's very early days to know the case fatality rate. And I've been tracking locally here in Georgia for the state of Georgia and, you know, as part of our public health efforts to inform the public, looking at rates of new cases and fatalities and case fatality rates and cases per capita and things like that and doubling times. Locally here in the very hyper-local area around Athens-Clarke County, but also in Georgia as a whole, and I've just started doing it for Michigan as well. And when you look at that, there's a lot of noise in the data, a lot of uncertainty. You go from having 500 new cases to 1,500 to 600, and there's no way that that can be real. Part of that is artifact in terms of how much testing is going on. And of course, mortality lags behind the cases. So I think we have a ways to go before we can really have any definitive knowledge. John?
No other comments on that one. I'll save my comments for later.
Okay. Excellent. Excellent. Go ahead, Henry.
All right. So the next paper is not yet published, really looks at a United Kingdom trial of just over 20,000 persons living in households who were randomized to get either a brief online hand-washing intervention or no access to this intervention. And during the subsequent 4 months, they found that the rate of respiratory tract infections in the intervention group was lower, about 51% versus 59% in the controls. That works out to be a number needed to treat of about 12. It also decreased the number of gastrointestinal infections. The number needed to treat for that was 25. And the good news is that people in the rest of the household also improved. So this is a simple lesson that we have been learning many times going back to 1847. In fact, the Google Doodle last week was devoted to Semmelweis, and I've been a fan of Semmelweis's writings for years. Sadly, he died at age 47 in an asylum. He was committed by his colleagues who thought that he was absolutely crazy, and they drove him nuts through all of the castigation. While he was in the asylum, he was apocryphally beaten by guards and developed gangrene in his hand and died in the asylum. And all of this was taking place before the era of Pasteur.
That's a really uplifting story.
well,
thanks for that, Henry.
Well, my word.
They're not feeling down
really,
enough.
The really good news is that the medical school in Vienna where he did all of this stuff is now the Ignaz Semmelweis School of Medicine.
Yeah, I'm sure that makes him feel a lot better. Oh, boy. No, I tell that story when I teach introductory to epidemiology. I used to teach that class when I first came to UGA and I had no seniority. They said, here, you teach the undergrads. But I like telling stories and I like telling that story as well. It's an important one. And the group that did that, Paul Little, Mike Moore, and the colleagues, they've done great in respiratory disease work for many, many years. And, you know, germdefense.org, defense is spelled with a C, it's the European or the UK style of defense. Yeah. So germdefense.org.
Well, the Semmelweis story is back in 1956, the year I was born, I'm a stamp collector, and Germany issued a series of 4 semi-postal stamps devoted to welfare organizations, and it was all based on midwifery, nursing, children nursing mothers, and Semmelweis was the fourth stamp of the. And so I give out that set to people who do a lot in patient safety and hand washing and the like. So,
oh, nice, yeah. Nice.
This really is a landmark study in many ways when you think about it, because thinking back to hand washing, it first became a big deal, obviously, with surgery, prior to surgery. And then people started talking about hand washing in the hospital to prevent transmitting infections from one patient to the next. And from there, it went to preschool and nursing type places where there were a lot of little kids, and there was a good randomized trial showing that hand washing made a difference. But this, in fact, is the first study that has ever shown a decrease in infection rates by household hand washing. First one. So this is a very interesting study. Thanks for presenting this one.
Well, it's time for John to cover a couple of updates.
Yes, in a small prospective study that has been accepted for publication but isn't in print, but you can find it on the web, the French investigators assessed virological and clinical outcomes of 11 consecutive hospitalized patients, a mean age of 59, who received hydroxychloroquine for 10 days and azithromycin for 5 days. So this is the combo, in fact, that is being used very regularly in seriously ill patients with COVID, partly to cover for opportunistic infections and partly because of the thought that hydroxychloroquine might work. So this is what happened. 8 patients had significant comorbidity. So at the time of the initiation of treatment, 10 of the 11 patients had fever and were on nasal oxygen therapy. So these were moderately to severely ill patients. Within 5 days, one patient died, 2 were transferred to the ICU, and one other patient developed a prolonged QT, not heart block, but prolonged QT, so they had to stop it. Now, what they did then was they repeated the nasopharyngeal swabs in the 10 patients who were still alive using qualitative PCR, and they were still positive in 8 of the 10 patients at days 5 and 6 after treatment, indicating that there had been very little clearance of the virus with that initial treatment course. This is very different from another study done in France where there was a high clearance rate of the virus. So it does cast real doubts about any strong antiviral efficacy of this combination. And of course, we're still waiting, as Mark said earlier, for bigger and better studies. But as I said, this is a combo that is being used quite commonly around the United States as well as Europe.
Yeah, so I've seen three small comparative trials, 2 randomized, 1 not. One showed no benefit, 1 showed some benefit, this one showed no apparent benefit. So, so far not making me too optimistic, but again, early days. And I think a lot of it also might have to do with issues around dosing, with patient selection. Is this something that is primarily, if it works at all, in sicker patients, or is it better to give earlier on? You know, we just don't know any of that yet. Comments, Henry?
I think I made my comments earlier, and keep those cards and letters coming.
Thanks. Okay, I think John is going to finish it off with a discussion of an editorial that appeared in the New England Journal.
Yes, just this past week, written by Harvey Feinberg, who is a former dean of the Harvard School of Public Health, also former provost of Harvard University and former president of the Institute of Medicine. So he obviously has some real credentials. He strongly recommends 6 steps, he says, to crush the coronavirus outbreak in the U.S. So I'll just read them. 1 is establish a unified command. I think we've had a little difficulty with that in this country. 2, make millions of diagnostic tests available. Also slow on the uptake, but I think we may be getting there. 3, supply health workers with PPE and equip hospitals to care for a surge of severely ill patients. Again, I don't think we get an A on that one. 4, differentiate the population into 5 groups: infected, presumed to be infected, exposed, not known to be exposed or infected, and adequately immune, a la the testing that Mark talked about earlier. 5, inspire and mobilize the public. And 6, learn while doing through real-time fundamental research, which, by the way, Mark is involved in a study that's just getting off the ground. So people are researching this. I thought the most novel suggestion he had to make was differentiating the population into 5 groups, because it's only when we start doing that that we'll be able to reopen things and differentiate what patients, what people should be doing what.
I've heard about people proposing sort of an immunity card, where if once you test positive for IgG, that you have a little card that allows you to get out of jail free and, you know, go mingle. So who knows where we're going to end up. Yeah, we just I had an idea for a study on Thursday. I applied for human subject submissions Friday. They responded Saturday and Sunday. They approved it, not quite approved it yesterday, but we did finally get it approved today. And we started collecting data at 2 o'clock this afternoon, less than 5 days after I actually had the idea for the study. And we already have 10 patients enrolled, I just saw. So what we're doing is we're looking at patients being tested for COVID-19 in a primary care setting and looking at their baseline signs and symptoms, respiratory rate, and a C-reactive protein, and seeing if we can identify those who tend to have a benign course from those who are more likely to deteriorate. So we're sort of building this airplane while we're trying to fly it. And the IRB has been remarkably responsive, which is great, because they realize that this is an urgency to get these kind of studies done. So yeah, lots of people are doing studies, and really the scientific community has really rallied and pulled together for this, which is very encouraging. Well, that was it. We're doing something a little different here. And give us your feedback. You can send me an email at my last name, ebell@uga.edu. And we will be back in a week with our regular podcast, and then in 2 weeks with another COVID-19 update, or maybe sooner. We'll just see what the research gives us. We hope you enjoyed today's discussion. Tell your friends. We'll talk to you soon with more primary care updates.